Her computer server held not just a handful of classified documents, but 110 emails in 52 email chains determined by the owning agency to contain classified information at the time they were sent or received. Separate from those, about 2,000 additional emails were up-classified, meaning they were later determined to contain classified information that someone in Clinton's position should have recognized immediately upon reading them. Former Deputy Assistant Director of the FBI, Denny Colson, believes that Comey's statement that he knew of no other comparable cases that would support charging Clinton shows the director was either thoroughly uninformed or severely biased in favor of the ex-Secretary of State. All of these individuals were prosecuted for doing a lot less than Clinton did. I don't know how Comey can look at those cases and look at what he recommended for her and not see the inconsistency, unless you come to the conclusion that he got the result he preconceived. The criminal intent canard. In his quest to exonerate Clinton of any wrongdoing, Comey decided to focus on the suspect's intent and then proceeded to misconstrue the law that governs intent. His tortured logic was set forth in this key sentence during his July 5th announcement. Although we did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information. First, nowhere in Title 18, U.S.C. Section 793F of the Espionage Act, which governs the grossly negligent handling of classified information, does it state that a defendant must have intended to break the law in order to be charged or found guilty. In clearing Clinton on this basis, Comey inferred language that does not exist. He either misinterpreted the law or chose to rewrite it. The plain language of the statute is unmistakable. No intent is required. It states, whoever being entrusted with or having lawful possession or control of any documents relating to national defense, through gross negligence permits the same to be removed from its proper place of custody, has committed a felony. Unlike other sections of the same statute, the word willingly was omitted. This was a deliberate decision by Congress when it revised and expanded the Espionage Act decades after it was enacted. Section F was added to provide a lesser alternative to willful conduct, that is, grossly negligent behavior. Second, the other sections of Title 18 U.S.C. Section 793, except Provision F, do indeed have an intent or willful requirement. They state that willfully or intentionally retaining classified information in an unauthorized place or transmitting it to an unauthorized person is a felony. Clinton also violated these provisions of law in two ways, by intentionally storing classified emails in an unauthorized place, her home, knowing they would be vulnerable to foreign access, and by intentionally giving all of her emails, including classified documents, to her lawyers and others for sorting. They did not appear to have received classified security clearance to review them. Despite all of this, Comey once again misapplied the law of intent in clearing Clinton. The plain meaning of the statutory language and the accepted legal standard is not whether Clinton intended to violate the law, as Comey claimed, but whether her actions were intentional. Unquestionably, they were. Even if one were to accept Comey's interpretation, the statute also makes it a crime if the possessor of classified documents has reason to believe it could be used to the injury of the United States or to the advantage of any foreign nation if it is kept in an unsecured place. How was it possible that Clinton did not have such a reasonable belief? She must have. Anyone in government knows all too well how classified documents must be protected from foreign theft. Failure to safeguard them could cause injury to the U.S. Under the Espionage Act, it is not necessary to prove Clinton intended to jeopardize national security or to aid a foreign power, only that she had reason to believe it could occur as a consequence of her deliberate actions. This is why Clinton was instructed on her first day on the job that all such materials must be maintained in a government-approved and secure location. Her home was not. Clinton knew this and therefore had reason to believe her actions would jeopardize national security. Remember, Comey openly admitted this in his July 5th statement when he said, "There is evidence to support a conclusion that any reasonable person in Secretary Clinton's position should have known that an unclassified system was no place for that conversation," referring to 7 email chains involving top-secret communications. Clinton didn't just keep classified documents in an unauthorized place, but she willingly gave them to people she knew did not have security clearance to receive them, in violation of the law. Comey acknowledged that his investigation had discovered this when he was cross-examined by Representative Jason Chaffetz during a hearing before the House Oversight Committee a mere 2 days after he cleared Clinton. Chaffetz: "Did Hillary Clinton give non-cleared people access to classified information?" Comey: "Yes. Yes." According to Representative Trey Gowdy during the hearing, Clinton gave up to 10 people access to classified information, and none of them were permitted to have such protected materials. It is truly baffling why she was not prosecuted on this basis alone. Third, the Espionage Act is not the only law that criminalizes the mishandling of classified documents. Title 18 of the USC, Section 1924A, makes it a crime to knowingly remove classified records without authority and with the intent to retain such documents or materials at an unauthorized location. The language of this law properly states the legally accepted intent standard. It does not require that Clinton intended to violate the law, as Comey stated. Since she never sought authorization for the server that stored them, she should have been charged under this statute. During her March 10, 2015 news conference, Clinton admitted that she intentionally used her personal server for the sake of convenience. She deliberately refused to utilize a government email account on a secure server hosted by the Department of State, and her top staff fought efforts to have her do so, as the FBI confirmed. These are the intentional acts that placed 110 classified documents in a vulnerable location and that, in the end, exposed America's national security secrets to foreign intrusion. As I explained in Chapter 1, Clinton had been told at the outset of her service as Secretary of State that this was against the law, and she acknowledged she understood it when she signed the document entitled Classified Information Non-Disclosure Agreement. The evidence is conclusive that Clinton knew she was committing crimes. Clinton was grossly negligent. Setting up an unclassified email server that houses classified material is the definition of grossly negligent behavior under the Espionage Act. And the sheer quantity of classified information, 110 documents, is evidence of gross negligence. Yet Comey managed to either ignore the law or turn its meaning upside down. He described Clinton's actions as extremely careless. What is the difference? There is none. In courtrooms across America, the terms gross negligence and extremely careless are devoid of any difference and hence synonymous. When juries struggle with the meaning of gross negligence, judges will often explain that it is behavior of a reckless or extremely careless nature. By describing Clinton's conduct as extremely careless, Comey was admitting that Clinton broke the law, although he twisted the language and the statute to create the appearance that she did not. Former federal prosecutor Andrew McCarthy explained it this way: "Substantively, these terms are indistinguishable. The emendation is said to be critical, though, because the statute applicable to Clinton's conduct criminalizes gross negligence. If Comey had said the words grossly negligent, so the story goes, it would be the equivalent of pronouncing Clinton guilty. That is, it would be impossible to rationalize not charging her because, after all, this was all about negligence." Instead, Comey cleverly altered the language to create the public impression or illusion that Clinton had barely skated across the thin ice of illegality when, in truth, she had plunged right through. Comey must have known Clinton committed felonies because an early version of his so-called exoneration statement, written in May 2016, did, in fact, use the words grossly negligent to describe Clinton's handling of classified information. Here is how he recounted Clinton's conduct in the original draft. "There is evidence to support a conclusion that Secretary Clinton and others used the email server in a manner that was grossly negligent with respect to the handling of classified information. This finding would have led to a criminal referral for prosecution of Clinton and an inevitable indictment. But it never happened, and almost no one knew this is what Comey had first determined. 2 years after Comey scuttled the case against Clinton, documents uncovered by John Solomon of The Hill showed that the words grossly negligent had been edited out with red lines on or around June 10, 2016, 3 weeks before the FBI interviewed Clinton. The term extremely careless was substituted. These alternative words on their face seemed less culpable and more innocuous. But the law views them as identical to gross negligence. Thus, it appears that Comey sought to draw a fine distinction where none exists. By avoiding the exact language of Title 18 of USC Section 793F, Comey managed to exculpate Clinton by employing a legal charade. Documents made available by the Senate Homeland Security Committee also show that Comey originally found another basis to conclude that Clinton broke the law. In his draft statement, he noted the following. Similarly, the sheer volume of information that was properly classified as secret at the time it was discussed on email, that is, excluding the up-classified emails, supports an inference that the participants were grossly negligent in their handling of that information. This finding reinforced the conclusion that Clinton committed crimes. In other words, there were so many classified documents on her unclassified system that she had to have been grossly negligent under the criminal statute. However, this part of Comey's statement was also later modified in a critical way. The entire reference to the inference of criminality was deleted. Former federal prosecutor Doug Burns believes Comey fully realized that Clinton committed several felonies, but decided to rewrite the law and reshape the facts to clear her. It was beyond embarrassing to see the director of the FBI twist himself into a pretzel trying to explain the non-prosecution decision in the Clinton matter. He violated every rule in the book. Agents do not make prosecutorial decisions, and prosecutors would never lay out the proof of the crime and then bizarrely explain that no case is being brought. His explanations about intent and carelessness were wrong legally and, again, totally embarrassing. Did Comey obstruct justice? These actions by Comey raise the specter that the FBI director may have been motivated to absolve Clinton for reasons that have little to do with the law and the facts. If so, this could constitute obstruction of justice. The best evidence that shows Comey cleared Clinton for political reasons is that he wrote his statement exonerating her several weeks before all the facts were known. According to the Senate Judiciary Committee, transcripts of interviews with people close to the FBI director prove that Comey drafted his statement well in advance of the FBI's interviews with Clinton and 16 other witnesses. How can that be? Comey could not possibly have known what legal conclusions to draw in the absence of fundamental facts that only those key participants could provide, especially the subject of his investigation, Clinton. Comey must have been determined to absolve Clinton, regardless of what she or others had to say under FBI questioning. Fred Tesi, who was an assistant U.S. attorney in Philadelphia and later special assistant U.S. attorney at the Department of Justice, believes Comey threw the case to protect Clinton. The investigation was a sham, a farce. They wrote the press release announcing the results of the investigation before the investigation fully took place. The fact that they even bothered to interview her was a joke. Clinton could have told them, "Yeah, I stole everything. The computer was illegal. I knew what I was doing was wrong." And they would have said, "Thank you very much, Madam Secretary. Have a nice day." And then they would have issued the press release they had written weeks before, announcing that there wasn't enough evidence to prosecute. It was a joke. All the former federal prosecutors and former top officials at the FBI who were interviewed for this book said they had never seen such a practice. They described it as wrong and in violation of FBI standards. The Senate Judiciary Committee accused Comey of predetermining the outcome of the case against Clinton. Mr. Comey had already decided he would issue a statement exonerating Secretary Clinton. That was long before FBI agents finished their work. Mr. Comey even circulated an early draft statement to select members of senior FBI leadership. The outcome of an investigation should not be prejudged while FBI agents are still hard at work trying to gather facts. Conclusion first, fact gathering second. That's no way to run an investigation. The FBI should be held to a higher standard than that, especially in a matter of such great public interest and controversy. Why would Comey change the crucial language to clear Clinton in the face of incriminating evidence that she mishandled classified material by both intentional acts and through grossly negligent behavior? Did Comey absolve Clinton for political reasons? Was he pressured to do so by Attorney General Loretta Lynch or others at the Justice Department? Did top officials at the FBI, motivated by corrupt purposes, dissuade him from making the criminal referral which his original draft statement so plainly set forth? And why exactly did he take it upon himself to usurp the authority of the Justice Department in clearing Clinton? If Comey prevented the prosecution of Clinton in the face of sufficient and compelling evidence to indict her, or was complicit in doing so, as the evidence indicates, then such interference or intervention in the due administration of justice would rise to the level of obstruction of justice by Comey. Title 18 of USC Section 1505 makes it a crime to obstruct justice. Whoever corruptly influences, obstructs, or impedes or endeavors to influence, obstruct, or impede the due and proper administration of the law under which any pending proceeding is being had before any department or agency of the United States shall be fined under this title, imprisoned not more than 5 years, or both. The operative word in the statute is corruptly. What does it mean? Courts have struggled with its meaning over the years, which is why Congress decided to define it in Title 18 U.S.C. Section 1515b as acting with an improper purpose, personally or by influencing another, including making a false or misleading statement, or withholding, concealing, altering, or destroying a document or other information. Thus, clearing Clinton for a personal or political reason could easily amount to a corrupt or improper purpose constituting obstruction of justice. So too would the act of altering an exoneration statement with a false finding of extremely careless if the facts determined that Clinton's actions were grossly negligent. Comey was asked under oath by the House Judiciary Committee if he decided not to pursue criminal charges against Clinton before or after she was interviewed by the FBI. He testified after. However, the documents uncovered by the Senate Judiciary Committee belies his testimony. A full 2 months before the FBI ever interviewed Clinton and her top aides, Comey began drafting the statement that he used to exonerate Clinton. Absent some extraordinary explanation, it appears that Comey's investigation was little more than a charade and that he may have lied under oath. If true, it would constitute the crime of perjury under Title 18 of USC, Section 1621, or a false statement under Title 18 of USC, Section 1001. This document establishes persuasive evidence that Comey preordained that Clinton would not be charged. What prosecutor writes a statement absolving a suspect before the evidence is fully gathered, especially from the principal witnesses? No prosecutor of which I am aware. Unless, of course, the fix was in. Unless someone instructed or encouraged him to protect Clinton, or he decided to do it all on his own with a presidential election hanging in the balance. Either way, it is evidence of obstruction of justice. It is a felony to interfere with a criminal investigation, even if you are in charge of it. It is also illegal to use your public office for a political purpose, if that is what Comey did. Former FBI Assistant Director Bill Gavin, who spent 28 years with the Bureau, said he had never heard of anyone in the FBI, including the director, composing an exoneration statement prior to the conclusion of an investigation. He referred to it as unprecedented and wrong. Former Assistant Deputy Director Buck Revell agreed, calling it inconsistent with the duties and responsibilities of the FBI. That is totally outside the scope of any reasonable course of action. It never happened to my knowledge, and I ran operations for 10 years. I know what happened back then. It would have been something that caused me to go to the Congress and say that we've got a conflict of interest in our own organization. The questions then become twofold. Did Comey do this on his own? Did others exert pressure or unduly influence him to exculpate Clinton? Facts later emerged suggesting that the investigation was corrupted by several people from within the FBI and the Justice Department. Loretta Lynch and a series of fantastic coincidences. We are expected to believe it was a coincidence that former President Bill Clinton just happened to be on the tarmac of Sky Harbor International Airport in Phoenix, Arizona, at exactly the same time as Attorney General Loretta Lynch on June 27, 2016, a scant 5 days before Hillary Clinton was to meet with FBI officials for questioning about her suspected wrongdoing. Perhaps it was also just a coincidence that 8 days after the furtive tarmac meeting, the decision was announced that criminal charges against Clinton would not be filed. We are supposed to accept that the private meeting on board Lynch's plane had nothing whatsoever to do with the criminal investigation of Clinton that the AG was overseeing at the time, and that it was a primarily social interaction. The optics, if not the substance, were beyond improper by any legal and ethical standard. The husband of the subject of a criminal investigation was meeting with the one person who could decide whether charges would be brought against his wife. Had a local reporter not been tipped off about the rendezvous, no one would have ever known about their discussion that reportedly lasted for half an hour. The secret meeting would have remained a secret, and in all likelihood, Lynch would have not felt compelled to accept whatever recommendation was made by Comey. Lynch should never have presided over the Clinton email case to begin with. She owed her career to none other than Bill Clinton, who nominated her to serve as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, which nicely positioned her for elevation to Attorney General a few years later. She should have recused herself from the Clinton probe at the outset, but never did so. Even when the ethically challenged tarmac meeting took place, she refused to recuse herself, saying she would accept the recommendation of the FBI. Lynch was required under law to disqualify herself. Under the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 28 of CFR, Section 45.2, no employee shall participate in a criminal investigation or prosecution he or she has a personal or political relationship with any person or organization substantially involved in the conduct that is the subject of the investigation or prosecution. Lynch had both a personal and professional relationship with Bill and Hillary Clinton. The private tarmac meeting underscored their close personal connection, and Bill's selection of Lynch for a high-ranking position at the Justice Department is evidence of their professional association. The Democratic-led Justice Department's objectivity and independence were already being questioned when the meeting occurred. But we are supposed to believe the Lynch-Clinton encounter was just an innocent coincidence of a casual social nature. Why then did the FBI on the scene instruct everyone that no photos, no pictures, no cell phones could be used to capture what took place? When the confab became public, the American Center for Law and Justice, or ACLJ, requested any and all records of the meeting and were told by the FBI that no records responsive to your request were located. A year later, the DOJ produced more than 400 pages of emails, although the contents of what Lynch and Clinton discussed were heavily redacted. The emails do reveal that reporters for the New York Times and the Washington Post seemed inclined to minimize the matter as an innocuous non-story and reached out to Justice Department officials to reinforce that view. Comey, for his part, told Congress almost a year later that he became suspicious of Lynch's motives and lost faith in the Justice Department's investigation following the tarmac encounter. This, he said, became his justification for deciding, on his own, to assume prosecutorial authority over the probe, although the evidence shows he had already taken steps to assume command even before the meeting. Testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee on May 3, 2017, Comey made a cryptic statement about impropriety at the Department of Justice. A number of things had gone on which I can't talk about yet that made me worry that the department leadership could not credibly complete the investigation and decline prosecution without grievous damage to the American people's confidence in the justice system. Comey was asked in the hearing about an email that reportedly provided assurances that Lynch would protect Clinton by making sure the FBI investigation didn't go too far. The director responded, "That's not a question I can answer in this forum, because it would call for a classified response. I have briefed leadership of the intelligence committees on that particular issue, but I can't talk about it here." It is doubtful that his response would involve anything classified. It appeared to be an excuse to keep the matter hidden, as it remains. A month later, Comey raised even more suspicions about Lynch and potential impropriety when he told the Senate Intelligence Committee that the then Attorney General had instructed him to mislead the public about the true nature of the Clinton investigation. Comey testified, "The Attorney General had directed me not to call it an investigation, but instead call it a matter, which confused and concerned me." In follow-up questions, Comey said Lynch's request concerned me because that language tracked with how the Clinton campaign was talking about how the FBI was doing its work. In Comey's mind, Lynch was not evaluating the law and facts objectively, as was her duty. Instead, she was actively attempting to help Clinton beat the rap. Comey's self-serving explanations for recommending that Clinton not be prosecuted were contrary to the law and raised more questions than answers. If he believed that Lynch was biased and determined to protect Clinton, why didn't he take more aggressive action to expose it? He should have immediately notified leaders of Congress or the Justice Department's Inspector General. He did neither, choosing to remain silent. If he felt that there was corruption born of a conflict of interest and nothing was being done to correct it, he should have resigned his post and exposed his suspicions to the public. Comey's failure to act suggests he had his reasons for commandeering complete authority over the Clinton case in order to accomplish the outcome he had already predetermined in her favor. Former U.S. Attorney Joe DeGeneva, who also served as an independent counsel, surmised that Comey and Lynch were motivated by a desire to see Clinton become president. What Comey and Lynch did was to corrupt the statute to save Clinton. Everything that Comey said at the news conference was false. Clinton had clearly violated the Espionage Act. There just isn't any doubt about that. For him to say that no reasonable prosecutor would bring the case was ludicrous, because reasonable prosecutors have been bringing cases over far less than that for years. Comey knew that. He became an embarrassment that day because everything he said was false, and he did it for one reason: to help Clinton become president. Comey's decision angered FBI agents. FBI Director Comey's decision to let Hillary Clinton off the hook proved to be an extremely unpopular one within the Bureau. A senior FBI official close to the investigation told Fox News that career agents and attorneys on the case unanimously believed the Democratic presidential nominee should have been charged, and the decision left members of the investigative team dismayed and disgusted. The October 13, 2016 story revealed that more than 100 FBI agents and analysts developed the evidence along with six attorneys from the Justice Department's National Security Division Counter-Espionage Section who reviewed what laws Clinton broke. No trial-level attorney agreed. No agent working the case agreed with the decision not to prosecute. It was a top-down decision to decline to bring charges against Clinton, the insider confided. In other words, Comey and several of his top aides, perhaps in collaboration with the DOJ, chose not to pursue an indictment. "It is safe to say the vast majority felt she should be prosecuted," said the source. "We were floored while listening to the FBI briefing because Comey laid it all out and then said, 'But we are doing nothing,' which made no sense to us." It was especially confounding because a grand jury was never fully utilized, nor was there any indication that search warrants were issued. All of this would be customary in a case involving potential national security breaches caused by the mishandling of classified information. These departures from normal procedure were obvious red flags and deeply alarming to the agents who were working the case. Thus, the entire process seemed distorted and illegitimate from the outset, as if the investigation was nothing more than a subterfuge designed to cover up illegality. The story by Fox News reporters Malia Zimmerman and Adam Housley also pointed out a strange and suspicious twist. Another oddity was the five so-called immunity agreements granted to Clinton's State Department aides and IT experts. Cheryl Mills, Clinton's former chief of staff, along with two other State Department staffers, John Bentel and Heather Samuelson, were afforded immunity agreements, as was Brian Pagliano, Clinton's former IT aide, and Paul Combetta, an employee of Platte River Networks, the firm hired to manage her server after she left the State Department. As Fox News has reported, Combetta utilized the computer program BleachBit to destroy Clinton's records, despite an order from Congress to preserve them, and Samuelson also destroyed Clinton's emails. Pagliano established a system that illegally transferred classified and top-secret information to Clinton's private server. Mills disclosed classified information to the Clintons' Family Foundation in the process, breaking federal laws. Why were these five people given immunity from prosecution? In almost every criminal case, immunity is only granted after a witness delivers a proffer, an offer of proof or evidence, that incriminates someone else and precipitates criminal charges. Yet no one, Clinton included, was ever prosecuted. The prospect of a Comey cover-up was further fueled by the inexplicable actions of the FBI when it reportedly destroyed the laptops of Samuelson and Mills after they received immunity. Why would the FBI erase or demolish computers with classified information contained therein? It appears the Bureau itself committed crimes by destroying evidence relevant to its own criminal investigation. But there's more. According to the senior FBI source, Mills was allowed to sit in on the interview of Clinton as her lawyer. That's absurd. Someone who is supposedly cooperating against the target of an investigation, being permitted to sit by the target as counsel, violates any semblance of ethical responsibility. Indeed, it does. Samuelson, a lawyer, was also permitted to be present when Clinton testified. It was not only irregular, but highly improper, unethical, and probably illegal. Under Title 18 of U.S.C. Section 207, it is against the law for former government officials like Mills and Samuelson to knowingly make, with the intent to influence, any communication before any officer or employee of any department or agency of the U.S. in connection with a particular matter they were once personally involved as government employees. It seems that there was never any serious possibility that Clinton would be charged for anything she might admit to in her July 2, 2016 interview. Otherwise, the FBI would not have allowed two immunized witnesses central to the prosecution's case to sit in the same room to hear her testimony. It is unheard of for prosecutors to permit such a thing because it would give those witnesses a chance to conform their testimony in such a way as to support the subject of the investigation, Clinton. During questioning before the House Judiciary Committee, Comey appeared to concede this point. It was bad enough that the immunity deals called for the FBI to destroy the laptops of Mills and Samuelson, thereby obliterating valuable proof that Clinton may have destroyed evidence in purging her server. But it was far worse for the FBI to treat Mills and Samuelson as suspects, accomplices, witnesses, and defense lawyers all at the same time and in the same case. By condoning unethical behavior, the Bureau simultaneously compromised the integrity and effectiveness of its own criminal probe. Of course, the FBI knew that. Somehow they didn't seem to care. There was no stopping the fix once it was well underway. FBI agents were also angry that Clinton was interviewed for only 3.5 hours on July 2nd. She reportedly answered, "I do not recall," or "I don't remember," some 39 times. At no point was she placed under oath. Comey cleared her of any wrongdoing 3 days later. "Every agent and attorney I have spoken to is embarrassed and has lost respect for James Comey and Loretta Lynch," the senior source told Fox News. "The bar for DOJ is whether the evidence supports a case for charges. It did here. It should have been taken to a grand jury." Several former FBI agents ventured damning assessments of both Clinton and Comey to Paul Sperry of the New York Post. Dennis V. Hughes, the first chief of the FBI's computer investigation unit, stated, "The FBI has politicized itself, and its reputation will suffer for a long time. I hold Director Comey responsible." Former FBI official I.C. Smith, who served as section chief in the National Security Division, observed, "Clearly there was a different standard applied to Clinton. What she did is absolutely abhorrent for anyone who has access to classified information." Retired agent Michael M. Biasello said, "Comey has single-handedly ruined the reputation of the FBI." Biasello claimed the outcome was predetermined, by design, and called Comey's decision cowardly. "When a decision makes no sense, it is reasonable to search for an alternative explanation or underlying reason that frequently exposes the sequestered truth." That explanation came into focus when the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, Michael Horowitz, decided to investigate Comey's mystifying decision. In the process, the IG uncovered the actions of a key FBI investigator by the name of Peter Sturzok, and the name of FBI lawyer Lisa Page also emerged. Text messages exchanged between them led to the identities of others, including FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, who appeared to have had personal and political motives to clear Clinton. Chapter 3. The Fix. Unlimited power is apt to corrupt the minds of those who possess it. Where law ends, there tyranny begins. William Pitt, Prime Minister of Great Britain, January 9, 1770. Very little was known about how FBI Director James Comey reached his decision not to pursue criminal charges against Hillary Clinton. Other than his public statement absolving her, nothing was revealed about the actions taken by agents and lawyers within the FBI who were intimately involved in the investigation and helped shape its improbable outcome. The Clinton exoneration statement and its evolution from criminality to absolution was a closely guarded secret within the agency. Americans were kept in the dark. So too was Congress. Why did Comey initially find that Clinton was grossly negligent in violation of the law, but then alter the critical language to clear her of wrongdoing? How could that have ever happened before any of the principal witnesses, including Clinton, were interviewed? It was puzzling, suspicious, and counterintuitive to the law. Had one or more individuals at the FBI put their thumb on the scales of justice to influence the result? As troubling questions persisted over the ensuing months, several names began to emerge. Andrew McCabe, Peter Sturzok, and Lisa Page. All three served as top FBI officials and were instrumental in the handling of the Clinton case. Together they wielded enormous power, including the power to corrupt the process. Andrew McCabe. During the early stages of the Clinton email investigation, McCabe was the assistant director in charge at the FBI's Washington field office. He was likely privy to the evidence being developed against Clinton. But in January 2016, nearly 6 months before Comey cleared Clinton of wrongdoing, he appointed McCabe to serve as deputy director of the FBI. McCabe was second in command at the Bureau and a close advisor to Comey. As such, he actively assumed oversight of the Clinton case and was intimately involved in the ultimate decision not to bring criminal charges against her. What few people knew at the time was how immersed McCabe had become in the same milieu as the Clintons. In early 2015, Dr. Jill McCabe, a pediatric physician, was recruited by Democrats to run for the Virginia State Senate just 5 days after Clinton's private email scandal became public. Was this sequence of events a mere coincidence? Dr. McCabe's campaign coffers were the beneficiary of some $675,000 from groups aligned with Clinton and Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, a longtime friend of Bill and Hillary Clinton and a former board member of the Clinton Global Initiative. The timing of the payments is curious. The big dollar donations to McCabe arrived 2 months after the FBI launched its investigation of Clinton in July 2015. McAuliffe personally solicited Dr. McCabe to run for office during a meeting that her husband also attended. The subsequent cash donations were an unusually extravagant expenditure for a statewide race and amounted to nearly 40% of her total campaign funds. The public knew none of this until 3 months after Clinton was cleared by Comey and his chief deputy, McCabe. The story broke on October 24, 2016, when Devlin Barrett reported it in the Wall Street Journal. No one was ever able to prove that Clinton's fingerprints were on the bags of money, but McAuliffe has never denied that he helped arrange the cash. Although there was severe criticism of McCabe within the FBI by fellow agents, the Bureau officially insisted that he did not begin his management of the email probe until after his wife's campaign ended, and he only became involved in the case months later when he was promoted to Deputy FBI Director in January 2016. Importantly, documents show that the FBI, knowing of his wife's cash connections to Clinton, never warned McCabe that he should stay clear of her email case, even after his wife lost her election. Instead, he assumed an executive leadership role guiding the Clinton investigation in the critical 6 months preceding the FBI's announcement in July 2016 that she would not be criminally charged. The FBI's defense of McCabe was both superficial and misleading. It makes no difference that his wife's campaign had ended. She still got the money. She was still indebted and beholden to Clinton and her close friend McAuliffe for their financial support of her. and Dr. McCabe's husband can hardly be described as an indifferent bystander with no interest in the matter. Spouses tend to support one another. That is why ethics advisors at the FBI cautioned him to recuse himself from all public corruption cases during his wife's Senate race. The conflict of interest was glaring, but the conflict did not suddenly end at the conclusion of his wife's campaign. Dr. McCabe took money from political action groups closely associated with the person her husband ended up investigating. Common sense dictates that the McCabes' gratitude and the corresponding propensity for bias would persist in perpetuity. The decision to clear Clinton may have been influenced by that very bias. This was a recurring problem throughout the investigation. Everyone involved was from a small circle of professional Washington insiders who all knew each other well and have for years. It did not matter whether there was a quid pro quo. Surely it would have been possible to find someone to determine Hillary Clinton's legal status in a fair and neutral manner. At the very least, the appearance of impropriety should have been more than enough for McCabe to disassociate himself permanently from the entire criminal investigation of Clinton. Moreover, FBI Director James Comey should have demanded it. He did not. The fact that Comey and McCabe declined to do so adds even more suspicion to the theory that the fix was in not to prosecute Clinton. Documents show that McCabe did eventually recuse himself from the Clinton probe just days after the Wall Street Journal disclosed the flagrant conflict of interest, the same conflict of interest that may have allowed Clinton to escape prosecution. Only then, when the FBI was under siege by the public disclosure, did McCabe reluctantly disqualify himself, reportedly at Comey's urging, a mere 1 week before the presidential election on November 1, 2016. At this point, of course, it was too late. His belated recusal was patently absurd since McCabe and Comey had already cleared Clinton and ended their investigation of her 4 months earlier. McCabe's recusal came at a point when Comey briefly reopened the Clinton investigation on October 28, 2016, when new emails were discovered, only to shut it down again 10 days later. Why would Comey and McCabe decide that the assistant director should disqualify himself then, but not before? Nothing had changed, except that his hidden conflict of interest had been exposed. Stepping aside in the 11th hour was an implicit admission that McCabe should never have had any role in the case to begin with. His prior involvement was not only improper and unethical, but seemingly corrupt. Tom Fitton, president of Judicial Watch, which obtained many of the McCabe documents through a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, said, "These new documents show that the FBI leadership was politicized and compromised in its handling of the Clinton email investigation." The Justice Department's Inspector General opened an investigation into McCabe's failure to recuse himself and whether he violated DOJ regulations in neglecting to properly disclose payments made to his wife. The IG, as well as the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Office of U.S. Special Counsel, also began examining whether McCabe violated the Hatch Act, which prohibits certain government officials from campaigning in partisan races. Photographs and other documents suggest he did. Senator Charles Grassley, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, was unsparing in his criticism of McCabe in a scathing letter to Director Comey on March 28, 2017. "You have publicly stated that the people at the FBI don't give a rip about politics. However, the fact is that the deputy director, McCabe, met with Mr. McAuliffe about his wife's run for elected office, and she subsequently accepted campaign funding from him. The fact is that the deputy director participated in the controversial, high-profile Clinton email investigation, even though his wife took money from Mr. McAuliffe. These circumstances undermine public confidence in the FBI's impartiality, and this is one of the reasons that many believe the FBI pulled its punches in the Clinton matter. FBI's senior leadership should never have allowed that appearance of a conflict to undermine the Bureau's important work." As McCabe's conflict of interest came into sharper focus, Congress demanded answers. He reportedly played a direct hand in altering Comey's statement that originally determined Clinton committed crimes. In doing so, he appears to have been one of three people who helped persuade the director and others to absolve Clinton of any wrongdoing. After months of resistance and under threat of a contempt of Congress resolution, McCabe finally acquiesced to pressure by agreeing to testify before Congress in December 2017. He came under withering scrutiny during two closed hearings before the House Intelligence Committee and a joint investigation by the House Oversight and Judiciary Committees. His testimony behind closed doors lasted more than 16 hours. Many members expressed unhappiness with the responses he provided when grilled about whether he allowed his own bias to intrude on the decision to clear Clinton. CNN reported, "The panel's Republicans forced McCabe to answer questions about internal emails they believed showed Comey mishandled the investigation, according to multiple sources. Two Republicans emerged from the Thursday hearing saying McCabe's testimony did not change their belief that Clinton got favorable treatment by the FBI when it decided not to pursue criminal charges last year over the handling of her private email server. What evidence the emails contained was not made public." Shortly before McCabe's appearance on Capitol Hill, Congressman Trey Gowdy, chairman of the House Oversight Committee, seemed contemptuous of the deputy FBI director's conduct and perceived Clinton bias. He told Fox News, "I'd be a little bit surprised if McCabe's still an employee of the FBI this time next week." Grassley was even more outspoken, venturing the opinion that he ought to be replaced, "and I've said that before, and I've said it to people who can do it," a reference to Christopher Wray, who had taken over from Comey when he was fired by President Trump in May 2017. In a manner, both Gowdy and Grassley were prescient. 2 days after McCabe's second acrimonious appearance before Congress, the news broke that he planned to retire within 3 months when he would become pension eligible. His anticipated exit removed pressure on Wray to demote or fire him for suspected misconduct. A month later, McCabe's name surfaced in a House Intelligence Committee memo as someone suspected of committing government surveillance abuses during the wiretapping of Trump campaign associates. At the same time, the Justice Department's Inspector General had accumulated evidence of wrongdoing by McCabe. Shortly thereafter, Christopher Wray removed him from his post as deputy director. McCabe was placed on what was described as terminal leave until his planned retirement took effect. 2 days before his planned retirement, McCabe was fired for just cause. His dismissal was approved by both the FBI and the Justice Department and endorsed by Attorney General Jeff Sessions after what he described as an extensive and fair investigation by the FBI's Office of Responsibility, or OPR, and the DOJ's Office of the Inspector General, or OIG. Both the OPR and OIG concluded that McCabe had made unauthorized disclosure to the news media and lacked candor, including under oath, on multiple occasions. In other words, McCabe did not tell investigators the truth more than once about leaks to the media. It turns out that the Inspector General reportedly determined that McCabe was untruthful 4 times, twice under oath. According to Representative Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, a member of the House Oversight Committee who obtained copies of the IG report, "It wasn't once, twice, it wasn't even 3 times. 4 times he lied about leaking information to the Wall Street Journal about the FBI. The IG subsequently sent to the Justice Department a criminal referral for potential charges against McCabe. If the findings of the Inspector General are true, this would be sufficient justification to bring criminal charges against McCabe for perjury or false statements." McCabe immediately issued a public statement denying he misled investigators and portraying himself as an innocent victim. But at the same time, he implicated Comey in his leak to the media, which could also result in similar charges against the former director. McCabe admitted he shared information with a reporter but stated the following, "As deputy director, I was one of only a few people who had the authority to do that. It was not a secret. It took place over several days, and others, including the director, Comey, were aware of the interaction with the reporter." This seems to stand in stark contradiction to what Comey told the Senate Judiciary Committee on May 3, 2017, when he was questioned at the outset by Chairman Charles Grassley about FBI leaks. Comey denied ever being an anonymous source to the media about the Trump or Clinton investigations, but then he was asked the following. Grassley, question 2, relatively related, "Have you ever authorized someone else at the FBI to be an anonymous source in news reports about the Trump investigation or the Clinton investigation?" Comey, "No." In his statement, McCabe admits he shared information anonymously with a reporter about the Clinton investigation and also contends that Comey knew about it, which means the then director may have either expressly or implicitly approved the leak. Was McCabe telling the truth, or was Comey? It cannot be both. James Kallstrom, who worked for the FBI for 27 years and became assistant director, said of McCabe, "I think nothing that he said was truthful from my understanding of his role at the FBI. What kind of an investigator was he? What kind of a supervisor? He was lacking in so many ways." Former Assistant Deputy Director Buck Revell, who knows McCabe, agreed. "I frankly thought he was weak. He didn't have the experience or the backbone to carry out that job. I was not at all satisfied with his abilities to give guidance to the director or to hold the fort on issues that the senior career person in the Bureau should be doing." In addition to McCabe's conflict of interest involving his wife, there is evidence that as deputy FBI director, he was instrumental in manipulating the facts and contorting the law to let Hillary Clinton off the hook, notwithstanding compelling evidence she committed a myriad of crimes. It appears he helped sanitize the infamous Clinton exoneration statement read by Comey. At first, it found evidence that she committed crimes, but then the wording was altered to clear her. It is believed that McCabe also signed off on warrant applications to spy on a Trump campaign associate, applications that obscured evidence and potentially deceived the court. This will be examined in forthcoming chapters. Did McCabe conspire with Comey and others to undermine the Clinton investigation and subvert justice? At the very least, did he allow a personal or political bias to influence the course of a case that should have gone the other way? If so, there were likely other individuals at the FBI who were involved. Peter Sturzok and Lisa Page. One of McCabe's senior advisors was an FBI lawyer named Lisa Page. She reportedly carried on a romantic affair with Peter Sturzok, who served as the FBI counter-espionage section chief under McCabe. Both Page and Sturzok were married to other people, but they worked closely together on the Clinton email investigation as key players involved in much of the decision-making. It was first estimated that they exchanged some 10,000 text messages during and after the probe, although the figure later ballooned to more than 50,000 messages. Initially, only a small portion of the texts, roughly 375 messages, were turned over to Congress in December 2017. Immediately, the content of the Sturzok-Page communications cast serious doubt on their objectivity and neutrality in assessing whether Clinton committed crimes. The politically charged texts showed a stunning hostility toward Donald Trump, denigrating him as an idiot and loathsome. At the same time, the texts were replete with adoring compliments of Clinton, lauding her nomination and stating, "She just has to win now." Sturzok played a pivotal role in Comey's announcement that he would recommend that no criminal charges be filed by the Justice Department against Clinton. As the lead investigator in the Clinton case, Sturzok is believed to have changed the critical wording in Comey's description of Clinton's handling of classified material, substituting the words "extremely careless" for "gross negligence." According to CNN, citing several sources, electronic records prove it. Another part of Comey's statement was also changed. Initially, he concluded that the enormous volume of classified documents on Clinton's servers supported the inference that she was grossly negligent. This would be sufficient for a finding of criminality. Yet this was also edited out of the final version made public during Comey's announcement on July 5, 2016. Was it Sturzok who engineered the edit to exonerate Clinton? Since he made the first edit, it is quite likely he made the second one. These alterations of key words were integral to the case and had enormous consequences, because they allowed Clinton to evade prosecution under Title 18 of USC, Section 793F of the Espionage Act. The changes effectively removed the only legal impediment to her election as president, assuming voters would go along. The incendiary texts of Sturzok and Page were discovered by the Justice Department's Inspector General during an internal investigation into Comey's disputed decision to clear Clinton. Impropriety and corruption were being examined. Here is a sample of several of the vehemently pro-Hillary conversations contained therein. Page: "God, Trump is a loathsome human." Sturzok: "Yet he may win." Sturzok: "Good for Hillary." Page: "It is." Sturzok: "Would he be a worse president than Cruz?" Page: "Trump? Yes, I think so." Sturzok: OMG, he's an idiot. Page, he's awful. Sturzok, God, Hillary should win. 100 million to 0. Page, I know. Sturzok, turn it on, GOP convention. The douchebags are about to come out. Page, and wow, Donald Trump is an enormous douche. Sturzok, hi, how was Trump other than a douche? Page, Trump barely spoke, but the first thing out of his mouth was, we're going to win so big. The whole thing is like living in a bad dream. Sturzok, Jesus. Sturzok, and hey, congrats on a woman nominated for president in a major party. About damn time. Many, many more returns of the day. Page, that's cute, thanks. Page, she just has to win now. I'm not going to lie, I got a flash of nervousness yesterday about Trump. Page, Jesus, you should read this story. Trump should go F himself. Sturzok, God, that's a great article. Thanks for sharing. And F Trump. Page, God, she's, Clinton, an incredibly impressive woman. The Obamas in general, really. While he has certainly made mistakes, I'm proud to have him as my president. Page, we do not want this election stolen from us. Sturzok, Trump is a fucking idiot. Members of Congress were outraged over the text messages and demanded that more of them be turned over for examination. On January 22, 2018, a second set of 384 pages of texts were made public. One message in particular revealed something stunning. Sturzok and Page knew that charges would never be filed against Clinton before she was ever interviewed by FBI agents, including Sturzok. The text dated July 1, 2016, one day before the Clinton interview, made a reference to Attorney General Loretta Lynch's decision to accept whatever conclusion was reached by the FBI. Sturzok, timing looks like hell. Will appear to be choreographed. All major news networks literally leading with AG to accept FBI D's recommendation. Page, yeah, that is awful timing. Nothing we can do about it. Page, and yes, I think we had some warning of it. I know they sent the same statement to Rybicki because he called Andy. Page, and yeah, it's a real profile in courage, since she knows no charges will be brought. How is it possible that in advance of Clinton's interview, a top FBI agent, a key FBI lawyer, and the Attorney General would all know that the target of their investigation would not be charged? The answer seems clear. The exoneration of Clinton was predetermined. The investigation was a sham. How would Lynch know that Clinton would be cleared? On the day he absolved Clinton, July 7, 2016, Comey made a point of saying, I have not coordinated or reviewed this statement in any way with the Department of Justice or any other part of the government. They do not know what I am about to say. This statement by Comey appears to have been untrue. According to Page, Lynch knew all about it. Perhaps it was because the Attorney General had been personally involved in seeing to it that Clinton was protected. Maybe she had only pretended to exclude herself from deliberations following the public outcry over her infamous tarmac meeting with Bill Clinton days earlier. A close look at Lynch's recusal shows that it was never a recusal at all. During a televised conversation at the Aspen Ideas Festival on July 1st, she announced she would accept the FBI's recommendations. But then she offered a carefully worded explanation of how her actions were not technically a recusal. A recusal would mean that I wouldn't even be briefed, she said. While I don't have a role in those findings or coming up with those findings, I will be briefed on it and I will be accepting their recommendations. The question remains, how would Lynch, Sturzok, and Page already know that Clinton would skate on criminal charges? Comey claims he didn't decide until after Clinton was interviewed on July 2nd. Here is what he told the House Judiciary Committee on September 28, 2016. All I can do is tell you again. The decision was made after that because I didn't know what was going to happen in that interview. And yet, Page's text message indicates that the decision not to recommend prosecution was made before Clinton sat down to speak with the FBI, including Agent Sturzok, and that the Attorney General knew all about it. But there is more evidence that Comey made his decision well before Clinton was interviewed. In a story published by The Hill, multiple sources who examined the early draft by Comey said the language of his statement was changed with red line edits to exonerate Clinton on or around June 10, 2016. If true, then Comey appears to have deceived or misled Congress, which is a crime. And the text messages between Sturzok and Page serve as corroboration.